From your world news headquarters on the World Wide Web, it's time for your daily dose of sanity. This is the Maria Heller Show. Maria Heller is a published author, founder of the Universal Wheel, a lifestyle and philosophy based on our interconnectedness to all living things, a Reiki master, and delivers the news with spiritual views. How many intuitive news decoders, animal rights activists, and vegetarian broadcasters are there? Just one. Maria. Maria has provided independent news for a smart audience for over 13 years now on the Maria Heller Show, available at maria.net.
M-E-R-I-A.net.
And now, here is your host, the mouth that roars, Maria Heller.
Good morning, world. Maria here, alive and kicking. How's everybody doing out there? Welcome to Roaring Truth with my guest, Jim Fetzer. And Jim and I were just talking off air about this seems to be the only show every month that seems to get hacked or whacked. But we'll see what happens today. Good morning, Jim.
Good morning, Maria. Great to be back with you.
I know. And what a month it's been. It's like the stories never seem to stop. And yet when I'm at the gym and I watch CNN, they have nothing to talk about. It's like a non-news show.
Some of these stories you couldn't make up.
No, I mean, especially the police stories that I get now every day. Shootings here, beatings here, cops getting off after they beat some guy to death, even though there was a full video of the beating in California. I mean, don't you think police should have to follow the same laws and rules the rest of us do?
Oh, yeah, even more stringently. It's just a sign of the lawlessness that has encompassed the United States. I mean, when Bush and Cheney just began completely ignoring the law, lying to the people over 9/11 and reasons to go to war in Iraq, ever since then it's been a downward spiral for the United States.
Absolutely. It's pretty scary to even look at this country and try to recognize it as the same country I thought I grew up in.
Oh, I feel that way too, Maria. It's astonishing.
Mm-hmm. Well, it looks like Obamacare is going to be one big flop. It seems that only old people are signing up for it, so they're already talking about the possibility of having to raise the premiums.
Well, it's all quite astonishing. I never saw a candidate, a president, deconstruct so devastatingly over such a short period of time. He'd spent years assuring us that if we liked our present plan, we could keep our present plan. If we liked our present doctor, we could keep our present doctor. And it all turned out to be rubbish. And apparently, he knew for at least 2 years in advance that what he was telling the public was false. Maria, the only case I can think of that comes close is now Chris Christie just falling apart before our very eyes. This is dumbfounding. I mean, the guy who is, turns out to be totally hands-on, to have a reputation for micromanagement, now claims he doesn't know what his highest aides were doing in relation to this closing of the George Washington Bridge. And it's just dumbfounded. They've even turned up emails where he contacted the governor of New York about it weeks and weeks and weeks ago, telling him to lay off the investigation of the bridge closing. I mean, how bad is that?
Right. Well, and that also opened him up to now being investigated on how he wasted the money from Hurricane Sandy on basically what looked like political ads.
That's right. There are two new investigations he's confronting now, and I don't think either is going to go very well for him. One is that his nemesis, John Wisniewski, who is the Democrat state assemblyman, has been leading the inquiry about the traffic chaos at the bridge, has announced the formation of a new super committee of the legislature that will pursue the investigation wherever the facts may lead us, and it will have the assistance of full legal counsel. And the second, which was just disclosed by CNN on Monday, involves a federal Department of Housing and Urban Development looking into whether the New Jersey government has used relief funds for the Superstorm Sandy to advance his public profile, just as you have observed.
Mm-hmm. Right. And, you know, he has shunned quite a few mayors that didn't want to play ball with him. So, you know, you look at him, and, yeah, I got to say, you know, he's starting to look more and more like Tony Soprano every day.
Well, it's unbelievable. And apparently the target wasn't actually the mayor of the city, but rather the state senator who had been a prominent opponent who represents that area. So it's really shocking. And, you know, once the comics, once the late night comics get a hold of this, you know, the man's in terminal trouble, because we had the Colbert Report saying, of Christie, it's my way or I'll shut down your highway.
I hate to say it, but, you know, for a while, they surely were building him up to be a presidential candidate in 2016. Oh. And now it almost looks like they're deliberately deconstructing him, too.
Well, there are efforts now by some, including the head of the Republican National Committee, to resurrect him and to claim he's going to survive this. But that's not how I see it, Maria. I think this is something he cannot overcome, and that his abuse of the trust of the people is so gross in this case. It's a kind of thing people are never going to forget.
Well, I guess we'll have to sit back and take a watch and see what happens. But, you know, with all that hubbub and movie stardom that he was rocketing to with Obama after Sandy, the fact that he would overspend something like over $2.2 million on his ads because he wanted pictures of himself and his families in them, instead of going with a lower bid, isn't going to look too good for him.
It's absolutely stunning, and I mean, it's so blatant. I just don't see any way out for him. I think he's, as I say, you know, stick a fork in him, he's done.
Well, it would have to be a pretty big fork. They showed a picture of him next to that crazy mayor of Toronto on Facebook, and they said, well, at least he doesn't smoke crack. And yet, look at that mayor. You know, they had a disaster in their town, and everybody was able to forgive him for being a crack smoking alcoholic because he took charge of what was happening in Toronto.
Isn't that unreal?
I mean, we live in the craziest world ever. Remember when we were kids, Jim, and you actually could look up to some politicians?
You know, Maria, when we were growing up, most of politicians were reputable, honest individuals who were seeking the best interests of the nation, and I think that can no longer be said.
Well, now you've got, we're being ruled by the 1%. That's something else I wanted to talk to you about. Two different parts of it. One, that we have a millionaire Congress, and two, when you look at Janet Yellen and the second in chief at the Fed, who happens to have dual citizenship with Israel and ran the Bank of Israel, you got to look at, you know, who really is ruling over us. You know, I tell people we indeed have a caste system in this country.
Yes, you know, the very first political speech I ever gave was at a Ron Paul Freedom Rally on 15 April 2008. And at the time, I was decrying the appointment of any dual citizens to any policy-shaping or decision-making position. In that case, of course, I was focusing on the neocons in the Department of Defense, who in collusion with the Mossad had brought us 9/11. But at the point that we had Michael Chertoff, who was becoming the first director of Homeland Security, another joint U.S.-Israeli citizen. We have Doug Zockheim, who was a controller of the Pentagon when it lost track of $2.3 trillion. You can well imagine where all that money went. And, of course, now we have the NSA surveillance, where all of its data is going initially to Tel Aviv, Maria. It's completely astonishing. Mm-hmm. And I think it accounts for why we have the bizarre situation that the Senate now has a bill to impose more sanctions on Iran that has 59 co-sponsors. I never imagined it would get to that point. So we have a Congress that is not only made up of millionaires and a government of, by, and for the rich, where I used to say, you know, in identifying myself as a liberal or progressive, that I believe everyone deserves representation, not just the rich. But it's no longer, you know, even the humorous aside. In fact, a friend of mine used to say, the Republicans are the party that believe the poor have too much money and the rich have too little. Mm-hmm. I'm afraid that's how it's playing out these days.
Exactly. And now you have Obama begging the House and Senate not to want to impose more sanctions on Iran, because as far as I know, as of the 20th of this month, Iran's on board doing what we're asking them to do. So you have a Congress that works against the president. I mean, we've seen this now for 4 years. I'm sick of it.
I am too. And in fact, the whole situation is bizarre because, as you well know, in 2007, all 16 U.S. intel agencies converged in the conclusion that Iran was not pursuing a nuclear weapons program, a conclusion it reaffirmed in 2011. Iran's declared policy is nuclear energy for all, nuclear weapons for none. They have signed the non-proliferation treaty. They have allowed inspectors. They're perfectly entitled to develop nuclear energy. And I think one of the hidden background issues is that it can produce fuel rods for nuclear power plants around the world at less cost and market them more cheaply than the American nuclear energy industry. And therefore, they're afraid of being undercut by Iran. But that's, you know, we claim we believe in capitalism and competition, Maria, but that's, of course, just a convenient myth. It's not true remotely. American corporations far prefer to have monopolies and to dominate markets than to have competition.
Right. Well, when you look at Iran, you know, we also have to face the facts that they're one of the few countries left that doesn't buy into the Rothschild's central banking system.
That's right. It looks as though we had a whole series of nations that were targeted, at least in large part on that ground, which of course include Libya, where Muammar Gaddafi was going to introduce the gold dinar as the currency for all of Africa. He was a benevolent dictator, which many students of political science will observe as the most effective and beneficial form of government. He was giving, sharing the oil wealth of Libya with the Libyan people. He was giving them free housing. He was giving $25,000 to newly married couples. He was undertaking one of the greatest engineering feats in all of the history of mankind with the great waterworks that would have made all of North Africa a fertile agricultural area. When the alleged rebel band, as its first act, declared the founding of a new central bank in Libya, I knew something was terribly wrong. Saddam Hussein, of course, had gone off of the petrodollar. That put him in our sights once again. They had a magnificent civilization there with antiquities and artifacts dating back thousands of years, a reliable infrastructure, providing water and electricity throughout the nation. They had a national system of health care and a public education, and we're lagging behind what they used to have under Saddam Hussein.
Right, they were better off. But he also didn't have... Well, look, the first thing that we did when we went into Iraq was bring back in the central bank.
It's absolutely shocking. And then, of course, Iran went off of the petrodollar, too, and opened an oil bourse where they traded multiple currencies. So I think that, you know, the combined interest of the Rothschild in seeking to found banks in the Middle East is one powerful motive, and trying to, you know, maintain the petrodollar, which really, absent its use as the common currency for oil transactions, is left without any foundation whatsoever. And in this case, I think the Muslim countries were targeted because usury, or making money off of money, is forbidden within Islam. So that, you know, they had to bring about a complete change or transformation in the situation in those countries in order to establish central banks that do nothing but practice usury, making money off of money.
Absolutely. And don't forget, you know, these Rothschild Zionists, you know, they claim or hide under pretending to be Jews. But if you read the Old Testament, usury is, you know, is a major sin and not allowed. And yet, you know, I hate to say it, who's in charge of all the usury all over the world?
Well, Jesus, as I recall from Sunday school, chased the money lenders off of the fronts of the temples. I mean, you know, how far have we gone? And as I recall, he's admonished the rich to give all their money to the poor, because it's harder for a rich man to enter the kingdom of heaven than it is for a camel to pass through the eye of a needle. Have we forgotten all of these messages?
Well,
there seems to be there are a lot of those who claim this is a Christian nation and we have a significant Christian population, but I don't see any indication that they practice what Christ preached.
Absolutely. Well, imagine if everybody practiced what their religion teaches, you know.
That's right. I know.
But they don't. Now, you talked about the NSA giving Israel first dibs on all their spying on us. And perhaps that's why Israel didn't seem to be as upset as other countries when they were informed via Ed Snowden that they were being spied on. And I was like, well, how could they complain about it when they've been legally spying on us for years, decades?
That's absolutely right. I mean, you can go back as long ago as Admiral Thomas Moore, who was the chief of staff right in the mid-80s, and he used to express his astonishment how the Israelis always knew what we were going to do before we did it. He got so he wouldn't write anything down, but I suspect that his office was actually bugged, so they were overhearing every conversation he had. Whether he wrote it down or not, they could anticipate his thoughts. And that seems to be going on, you know, around the world. This NSA thing is so completely disgusting, Maria. They have every item of information they could possibly want about our emails, our phone calls, our medical records, our financial transactions. They can anticipate developments in the world of commerce and business. They can make stock transactions based on inside information that net them millions of dollars. I mean, it's the wet dream of those who want to become the power mongers in this country, and their thirst for this information is utterly insatiable.
I totally agree, and yet there's a new study out that said that with all this with the NSA, they haven't really stopped one true case of terrorism.
Well, the fact is, a subcommittee of the Senate Committee on Homeland Security and Intelligence released a report as long ago as 3 October 2012 based upon its review of 680 Fusion Center reports obtained during 2009-2010 where Fusion Centers merged federal, state, and local anti-terrorist activity. And in that 680 reports, Maria, which is a massive sample taken from all over the country, they found not one, not a single instance of domestic terrorist activity, not a zip, zilch, nothing. Mm-hmm. Which means that domestic terrorist activity is virtually non-existent, which, of course, is why they have to fabricate and fake events like the Sandy Hook shooting. Mm-hmm. I'm very pleased to report that a new study that I co-authored with other members of the Sandy Hook Research Group has gone to number one on Veterans Today. It's available for everyone. Top 10 reasons Sandy Hook was an elaborate hoax.
Right, it's fabulous.
We go through, you know, point after point. Mm-hmm. We're simply stunning that even an article in the New York Times about the final report from the Connecticut State Department investigating this incident didn't name any of the alleged victims, didn't give their sex, didn't give their ages. Mm-hmm. And although there were allegedly 26 victims, there was an appendix with autopsy photographs, 52, which would be the wrong number, as I'll explain, unless there were exactly two apiece, mm-hmm. and they were all redacted. There's no proof that any of these alleged victims actually died at Sandy Hook. And, of course, as you well know, the clerk of Newtown engaged in secret negotiation with the state legislature so that she would not be required by law to release the death certificates to the public, even though death certificates like birth certificates, like marriage and divorce records have been available for the public on a routine basis for over 200 years.
Mm-hmm.
And then a state attorney went out of his way to try to deprive the public of access to the 9/11 calls, which really didn't show the kind of panic or concern you would expect had this been a real deal. And then those who were hired, the contractors, to tear down the school, which we believe was on the verge of being torn down anyway, and therefore was merely a prop for this event, were required to sign gag orders. I think the reason was not so they would not report things they observed, but things they did not observe, in particular pockmarks and bullet holes on the walls of the classroom or blood on the floor. Mm-hmm. Where it turns out that one of the active members of this research group, Kelly from Tulsa, had made phone calls. She's involved in biohazard cleanup and knows all the requirements in, that are obligated to be followed, even for something as modest as a child throwing up mm-hmm. in a lunchroom. They have to go through a whole series of steps to ensure proper disposal. And she contacted three state agencies, none of whom knew anything about the blood cleanup, and eventually was directed to the Lieutenant Vance, who had taken such an authoritarian role by threatening anyone who challenged the official report with prosecution. And she asked him who cleaned up the blood, and Lieutenant Vance's response was, what blood?
Right. And if there were so many shootings there, that place should have been covered in blood.
Well, it's completely ridiculous. And in fact, we have now, and we include it in the article, Top 10 Reasons, that there are Connecticut state laws that require a paper trail all the way from the source of the, you know, the material, the biohazard, to its disposal in an incinerator. And none of that was done.
Right. Well, you know, it kind of reminded me when they tore down the buildings, how fast they got rid of the evidence at, you know, Ground Zero in New York on 9/11.
Yeah, that's right.
And they broke a lot of laws doing that, because that should have been left there, you know, for an investigation that the city had a right to do, the firemen had a right to do.
Another stunning aspect of this is it appears to be the case that the alleged shooter, Adam Lanza, couldn't have even done the shooting. I mean, we've not only checked out Social Security Death Index data on him and find that officially, according to that data, which I now believe is subject to being rigged, that he died the day before on the 13th, not on the 14th, the alleged day of the incident. But this young man, who was nearly 6 feet tall, only weighed about 120 pounds, when he put together all the bulletproof vests he was carrying and all the weapons and the ammo, where he allegedly fired over 150 rounds, you know, in a short period of time with, after making multiple changes to the cartridges. I mean, it's just preposterous. And he had a ratio of kills to targets that was phenomenal, on the order of 96%. I'm a former Marine Corps officer, Maria, and I couldn't have performed this. I used to supervise recruit training, marksmanship training. I don't know anyone who could have done this. It's preposterous. And Wayne Carver, who was the medical examiner, said each of the children had between 3 and 11 shots apiece. That's just stunning. And yet we have no evidence that any of these children were actually dead. And in fact, there are reports from the national press that emerged that were widely broadcast at the time, showing they've been unable to establish the existence of Adam Lanza and thought he might be a fictional character. And another that showed, and they confirmed it with the federal, state, and local authorities, that only handguns were found with a body. Well, if only handguns were found with a body, how could the children have been shot with a long gun, which was the report of the medical examiner, whose own interview was rather bizarre in multiple respects, where James Tracy, who's been a leading student of Sandy Hook, has discussed it in a very widely read article on his Memory Hole blog, which everyone should access for the latest information on Sandy Hook.
Well, I am going to post a live link to that article on the top 10 reasons, because I thought it was excellent. It's nice and succinct, because, you know, people don't, they're too lazy to actually, you know, want to read something long or, you know, do some homework on their own. But I also noticed that a lot of supposed alternative media is joining the government story on what happened at Sandy Hook, because obviously they must be anti-Second Amendment or bought off. I mean, today, you know, a lot of people are talking about a lot of alternative media having been, infiltrated
co-opted.
All right.
Well, this is probably a response to this article and other research we've been doing. I had published an earlier article entitled Sandy Hook's Plus American Gullibility Equals Coming Gulag USA, where I made a whole lot of points here. I mean, just to summarize the 10 findings we have, proof of death has been suppressed, emergency protocols were not followed, drill protocols were followed instead, there was foreknowledge of the event, there was confusion over what weapons were used, the suspect cannot possibly have carried out the shooting, strange behavior was displayed by officials, witnesses, and relatives. There are many odd photos of the participants. The crime scene was destroyed under conditions of secrecy. And would you believe it also appears that some of the children participated in a singing event at the Super Bowl? I mean, how blatant can you get?
Right. Well, you know, watching Sophia's Small Storms movie, the things that really stuck out to me, in addition to what you said, was all the vehicles basically being the same, all the parents' vehicles being basically the same, and how many people that work for the federal government live in that town.
Oh, I think you're right. And it turns out that a lot of these families appear to have been moved into Sandy Hook 2 years earlier. and that they were deeded their homes at no charge by a government agency, and that it was done on December 25th. I mean, who does a, you know, commercial real estate transaction on Christmas Day? Not to mention that, you know, all the most blatant indications, there was even a sign there that we captured that I used as a feature image where, you know, everyone must sign in. There were porta potties there. There were people milling around. There were lots of people with name tags on lanyards. And there was a group of about 100 that was just coming out the firehouse door, circling the building, entering the back of the firehouse, coming out the firehouse door, circling the building. I mean, they were just walking in circles. That's all completely bizarre. And anyone who thinks that's standard for a school massacre really needs to have their head examined.
I agree. Well, let's jump across the pond a little bit. The big laying in state of Ariel Sharon this week, and the media whitewashing him like they tend to do with a lot of war criminals, and all of a sudden this guy's the hero.
This was a very bad man. I mean, even Menachem Begin or David Ben-Gurion observed to Sharon that he was a talented military commander, but he needed to learn to tell the truth. I mean, he had a notorious reputation for lying, which he followed throughout his entire career. He appears to have masterminded a couple of slaughters of Palestinian people in a brutal act. I mean, that was one of his characteristic traits, namely brutality. After 9/11, he boasted that Israel owns America and the Americans know it, where, of course, this was a contrived event that was intended to draw the United States into the Middle East to perform dirty work for Israel by deconstructing these modern, sophisticated Arab states that were serving as a counterbalance to Israeli domination of the Middle East. This was a very bad man. My opinion is, with his death, there's a slightly less evil in the world.
I agree. I was hoping he'd leave hand in hand with Barbara Bush, but once again, she seems to have survived pneumonia.
Yeah, well, those Bush families, you know, George H.W. was overheard explaining once that if the American people knew what they had done to the country, they'd be chased down the street and strung up. And I think the evidence really overwhelmingly supports that, including in an article, did George H.W. Bush coordinate a JFK hit team? Well, Maria, it seems very clear that he did. He was even arrested coming out of the Dow Tex building, from which three shots were fired. The only shots fired with an unsilenced weapon, which was a Mannlicher Gargano, which, true to its reputation for unreliability, even though these shots were virtually on the horizontal, involved two misses and one hit. Well, one of the misses hit a curb and injured a distant bystander named James Tague. Another missed and hit a chrome strip over the limousine windshield. But the third hit JFK in the back of the head after the driver, William Greer, had pulled the limousine to the left and to a halt to make sure he would be killed. This was, the whole limo stop was such a stunning indication of complicity by the Secret Service that they had to take it out, which led to the massive revision of the Zapruder film at a secret CIA photo lab located in Rochester, New York, adjacent to Kodak headquarters.
All right. Well, you know, he has to be the only living person on the planet who doesn't remember where he was when Kennedy was shot.
I know. He and Richard Nixon, if you can believe that. They both were deeply involved. Nixon was at the home of Clint Murchison Sr. the night before the assassination, where there was a ratification meeting. Richard Nixon was there. He was driven out by a local Republican leader who worked in the same bank building where Madeline Duncan Brown, a mistress of LBJ, was then a young advertising executive. She was present at the event and told me about it. We had over 100 conversations. J. Edgar Hoover was there. She thought perhaps it was in his honor that this event was taking place. H.L. Hunt, nominally his oil business competitor, was also there. John J. McCoy, our former High Commissioner to Germany, was there. When Lyndon would organize a Warren Commission, he'd appoint to the two allegedly civilian seats Alan Dulles, former director of the CIA, whom JFK had removed from office, and John J. McCoy, who was actually a participant at the ratification meeting to go forward, where Lyndon Johnson showed up late in the evening and these heavy hitters disappeared into a boardroom for 15 or 20 minutes. When it was over, Lyndon strode toward Madeline. She thought he was going to whisper sweet nothings in her ear. Instead, he told her in a hateful tone of voice that after tomorrow, he wasn't going to have to put up with embarrassment from those Kennedy boys any longer. Mm. 6 weeks later, during a rendezvous at the Driscoll Hotel in Austin, Texas, she confronted him with rumors rampant in Dallas at the time that he had been involved since no one stood to gain more personally. He blew up at her and told her the oil boys and the CIA had decided that Jack had to be taken out.
Right. Well, you know, I wanted to ask you, you know, I know you talked to Roger Stone as I did, and I read his book on JFK. He makes a case that Nixon was deliberately set up with Watergate because Nixon was pushing too hard for the truth on the Kennedy assassination. What do you think of that?
Well, Roger Stone was, you know, an inside insider about that time. And, you know, the Watergate thing has so many odd aspects to it. Those who were involved as the burglars appear to have also been involved in the assassination in support roles or whatever. And, you know, he might very well be correct about that. My understanding was he was going after information that might be held by the Democratic National Committee that could implicate him in the assassination of JFK, but that the whole thing, of course, went terribly awry. And I mean, the aspects of this are bizarre beyond belief. I think Roger Stone, on the whole, has a really excellent book here. He's mistaken, in my judgment, about the Tippit shooting because he implies that Tippit was supposed to shoot Oswald, but Oswald was already in the Texas theater by the time Tippit was shot. And then the ballistic evidence, the shell casings, there were four shell casings that have been ejected from automatics that were initialed by the first officer on the scene of two different manufacturers, two Western and two Remington Rand, are consistent with there having been two shooters. In fact, a woman across the street, Aquila Clemens, who was never interviewed by the Warren Commission, said there had been two shooters and neither of them looked like Oswald. I believe Tippit was involved in a peripheral way and perhaps helping some of those who were involved to get out of Dealey Plaza, but that he wasn't actually assigned to shoot Oswald. Rather, they shot him in an effort to implicate Oswald because they planted his jacket and also even a wallet. Can you believe, you know, shooting a policeman? Oswald only, and then leaving your wallet, Oswald only had a revolver, of course. And it's absurd to think he could have shot a police officer three times in the torso and then once in the head and opened the cartridge to remove the incriminating shell casings. I mean, the whole story about Tippit is vaguely absurd.
Absolutely. Well, Jim, we're going to go to a short break, but when we get back, you have an article that you co-wrote with Sherwood Ross on the actual six shooters. And I said, wow, finally, because everybody keeps saying, okay, but who actually pulled the trigger? So I want to talk about that when we come back. So stay with us, Jim, and I will be right back.
Wow. One solid hour of commercial-free information thanks to you. The person who wants truth has the integrity and understanding to support it with your donation and subscription. Maria believes people can handle the truth and delivers it tirelessly with those with ears to listen. 14 years on the net. Won't you take a moment right now to commit to a subscription of your choice at www.maria.net. That's M-E-R-I-A.net. Over 1,100 hours of pure education all in one place, 24/7 and all downloadable. Knowledge is power. Sharing that knowledge is wisdom. Together we can change the world and create real hope. Now let's get back to the Maria Heller Show.
Okay, welcome back to Roaring Truth with my excellent co-host, Jim Fetzer. I have links here to so many of his articles. Get over to veteranstoday.com, where his excellent work is showcased, and Jim has many, many, many books out there. And obviously, just from listening to him, you know what he knows, what he's talking about. Jim, so many years people are like, well, Maria, if you know so much, then who actually did shoot JFK? And, you know, after talking with Roger Stone and, of course, Malcolm Wallace, you know, LBJ's hitman, you know, he puts a lot of it on Malcolm Wallace. But I love the fact that you have this article out naming all six. And who knows if there were even one or two more. We'll never really know at this point.
Well, the paper, the article had an interesting evolution because I actually, you know, I had organized and was giving the keynote address for a 50th observance conference in Santa Barbara, entitled JFK, the Assassination of America. And I did a long interview with a small paper in Santa Barbara called the Santa Barbara Independent. And to my fair astonishment, they published most of the interview directly in the paper and then gave a link to the rest of the article online. And it is probably the longest interview about the conspiracy that was involved in the assassination of JFK that has ever been published in the American press. Mm-hmm. Well, after, you know, doing the conference, which was a great success and all that, I had interaction with Sherwood Ross, who thought it would be a really good idea to do something along this line. So, you know, he worked on a draft, and then I refined the draft. And he'd actually sent it out a good number of times when I noticed that we really needed to put in these images. So that I published it on Veterans Today, and then he began distributing the version, including the images, and he got it up all over the place. I mean, this article has made it all over the world. Maria, this article also went to number one on Veterans Today and stayed there for at least 10 days. I mean, it's really been quite a smash, and I think it's for the reason that, you know, most people just have no idea what actually was going on here. As I explain in the presentation I gave when I was moderating the other sessions, you know, for the Santa Barbara conference, which you can track down at jfk50santabarbara.com, by the way, I pointed out that it's much less confusing as to what went on if you draw a threefold distinction between the sponsors of the event. These are organizations or groups that are powerful that wanted JFK out primarily, with the exception of the anti-Castro Cubans, who wanted retaliation for what they falsely believe was JFK's betrayal at the Bay of Pigs, in order to get the policies of Lyndon Johnson into place and those of JFK out. And the facilitators, those who actually took the measures necessary to make it happen, and then on the ground, the mechanics, the actual shooters, and their supervisors and coordinators. Now, the sponsors included the CIA. Jack was threatening to shatter the agency into 1,000 pieces. He'd already placed its paramilitary activities under the supervision of the Pentagon. Neither of them liked that. He had disillusioned the Joint Chiefs because he had not invaded Cuba, contrary to the unanimous recommendation. He'd gone ahead and signed an above-ground test ban treaty with the Soviet Union against their unanimous opposition. Now he was going to pull our forces out of Vietnam, where they believed the stand had to be taken against the expansion of international godless communism. The anti-Castro Cubans, as I mentioned before, wanted retaliation for what they believed was his betrayal at the Bay of Pigs. The mafia was upset because Bobby was cracking down on organized crime for the first time in its history, with terrific effect, making a real impact on the mob's illicit activity. The Texas oilmen were worried that Jack was threatening to cut the oil depletion allowance, which they regarded as akin to their divine right. The Eastern banking establishment was worried that Jack had already instructed the Department of the Treasury to print hundreds of millions of United States notes on the ground that it was absurd for the country to be paying interest to a consortium of private banks for printing the currency of the United States. And finally, not least of all, Israel, because JFK had been butting heads with David Ben-Gurion, the first PM of Israel, over the Israeli desire to develop nuclear weapons at Dimona. JFK was insisting that there should be inspectors and discouraging opposing Israeli development of nuclear weapons, which he believed would lead to an arms race in the Middle East. And David Ben-Gurion appears to have resigned in protest, where it may be that his last instruction was that the Mossad should support the removal of JFK. Now, I give all this background because when we get down to the mechanics, each of these groups seems to have had their own shooter. So that, for example, Texas local law enforcement, the Dallas local law enforcement was, you know, very much involved in all of this. Mm-hmm. And in fact, the first hit on JFK appears to have been fired from the top of the county record building by a Dallas deputy sheriff by the name of Harry Weatherford, who was using a .30-06 to fire a smaller caliber bullet, a Mannlicher-Carcano bullet, using a small plastic collar known as a sabot, S-A-B-O-T, which hit JFK about 5.5 inches below the collar, just to the right of the spinal column. It was a shallow shot, and it appears that that is the bullet that worked its way out of his body and was actually discovered by the driver of the Secret Service limousine, according to a friend of his in whom he confided, assuming, of course, we're getting accurate reports from those two sources, but it does seem to make sense. Mm-hmm. So the first shot that actually was a hit was from this Dallas deputy sheriff. The second is a shot that passed through the windshield that hit JFK in the throat, which appears to have been fired from the south end of the Triple Underpass by an Air Force expert. So here you got the Joint Chiefs, you know, putting up one of their shooters, an Air Force mm-hmm. expert by the name of Jack Lawrence, who'd gone to work for the automobile dealership that provided the vehicles, which were all different makes and models and colors, probably the most bizarre presidential motorcade of all time, since they're invariably uniformly black, almost always Cadillac limousines. But in this case, the conspirators want to know who everyone was. By using different colors, makes, and models, they could easily ascertain. In fact, they took the president's military aide, who normally would have sat in between William Greer, the driver, and Roy Kellerman, the agent in charge in the passenger seat, and moved him to the very backmost limousine with the president's personal position, because had they not done so, the bullet that passed through the windshield and made the sound of a firecracker in doing so and hit JFK in the throat would have hit him instead. So there was lots of anticipation. Mm-hmm. Then we have the anti-Castro Cuban I mentioned before, fired three shots with one hit after the limousine was brought to a halt. His name appears to have been Nestor Tony Escadro, and he appears to have been supervised by George H.W. Bush in the Daltex building, where Bush even seems to have been arrested coming out of the building, identified himself as a independent Texas oil man, was taken off for interrogation and eventually simply released without being booked. Mm. But in the meanwhile, W, who appears to have been there with him, was wandering around slightly lost because he did not know where his father was. So if you go to that article I mentioned, did George H.W. Bush supervise the coordinator JFK hit team, you'll even find photographs of W that were taken in Dealey Plaza while his father appears to be off on an interrogation. Hmm. Now, because those were the only three unsilenced weapons, they set up an acoustical impression of only three shots having been fired, since all the rest were silenced. There was a Dallas police officer on the grassy knoll by the name of Roscoe White, who worked for the CIA, and who appears to have pulled his shot, probably because although it was the easiest, he would have hit Jackie instead. After the limousine came to a halt, and Jack was hit in the back of the head, he slumped forward. He was wearing this back brace. Jackie eased him back up and was looking him right in the face. That's when Roscoe White could have taken the shot, which wound up in the grass instead on the opposite side of the limousine. But instead a shot was taken from the north end of the Triple Underpass by Frank Sturgis, who was both a CIA and a mob guy with ties to the Meyer-Lansky Jewish crime syndicate, which had ties to Israel. And he fired the shot that entered the right temple of JFK, a frangible or exploding bullet that set up shockwaves that blew his brains out the back of his already weakened cranium to the left rear with so much force that he initially, the motorcycle patrolman impacted with that debris initially thought he himself had been shot. And then in the book depository, no shots were fired from the alleged assassin's lair. From the opposite side of the building, Malcolm Mack Wallace, who was Lyndon's personal hitman, who had murdered a dozen people for Lyndon, including one of his own sisters, was firing at John Connally in the mistaken belief that it was a liberal Texas senator by the name of Ralph Yarborough. In fact, JFK and Lyndon had a huge argument that morning where Lyndon tried to get Connally out and Yarborough in, but Jack overruled him on the ground that the chief executive of the state should ride with the chief executive of the United States. So that those are the six hitmen, where, you know, Roscoe White, Nestor Escadro, and Frank Sturgis all had ties to the CIA, where Lee Oswald was not one of the shooters. In fact, he was also actually captured in a very famous photograph taken by AP photographer James I. Alchins in the doorway observing the motorcade as it passed by.
Well, it's quite the eye-opener. When you look at it, you know, even reading your article, you know, here you have local cops in Dallas. It's happening at the book depository buildings in Dallas, the friends of Lyndon Johnson. Who else could have been better able to set this up in Dallas than Johnson?
Oh, you're absolutely right. And that brings us back to the facilitators, where the key players as the facilitators, on the one hand in setting the whole thing up, and the other covering it up, were Lyndon Johnson and J. Edgar Hoover. So we actually have, you know, more than 15 indications of Secret Service complicity in setting him up for the hit. We have the CIA military mafia, Anacastro Cubans, local law enforcement taking him out. We have J. Edgar using the FBI to cover it up. And then Lyndon, of course, appointing the Warren Commission and stacking it in such a way as to arrive at the predetermined conclusion, where he appears to have even, you know, shaken down Earl Warren, who as a chief justice had no business participating in an investigative panel, which was actually only a presidential advisory commission. Who knows the legal status of that? I think it's used, like the 9/11 commission, to create a facade and impression on the American people that there's been a serious investigation, when in fact what's going on is a whitewash. He seems to have told Warren that you know, that Oswald's background with the Fair Play for Cuba Committee and going to Mexico City, which appears to be a false story. In fact, the CIA had photographs of the man in Mexico City and the audio recordings of his voice, and even J. Edgar put out a memorandum to all of his agents in charge that someone was impersonating Lee Oswald in Mexico City, which I contend, if that's all you knew about the assassination, you'd already know it had to be a conspiracy. And told Earl Warren that if, you know, the truth was known, that Oswald was working for Castro, but that if they went after him, that there'd be a world war and 30 to 40 million people would die. So that his responsibility was to cover it up and, you know, fix the blame, cut it off with Lee Oswald, which of course is what they proceeded to do. But it all is completely shabby, and this has to be one of the deepest, darkest, black chapters in American history.
Absolutely. Well, I don't think they counted on the fact that people that were aware, like you and I were during the Kennedy assassination, would still be alive and make the connections when 9/11 happened, especially the similarities and the same cover-up and the same bullshit, the same lies and the same piss-poor investigation, if you want to call it an investigation.
Oh, you're absolutely right. The case of Frank Sturgis, by the way, is particularly interesting because I know a New York City Gold Shield detective by the name of Jim Rothstein, who arrested Sturgis when he came to New York in an attempt to kill Marita Lorenz, who knew all about the assassination from the inside out, so she could not testify to the House Select Committee on Assassination. She eventually did, and gave him three boxes of information about exactly how it was done, but which they completely ignored because they wanted to perpetuate the myth that Lee Oswald was a lone shooter. But they got wind of the plan, and when he came into Marita's apartment, Rothstein put a gun to his head and apprehended him. He made some remark like good shooting to draw him out. And he admitted that he fired that shot that had entered the temple and blown his brains out the back of his head. He said he was actually aiming for his eye, but the JFK had moved slightly, so he'd hit him in the temple instead, and that he had done it because of the betrayal at the Bay of Pigs, and because he was cavorting with beautiful women who were spies for foreign nations and therefore committing a national security risk. I mean, he was very open about his role here. I've also had confirmation from others who were friends of the family and friends about the role of the deputy sheriff, Harry Weatherford, who confirmed that that was indeed the case as they understood it, too. So, you know, I'm unaware of any critique, any serious attempt to counteract what I presented here, which, of course, is based on my distillation of some 20 years of research with the best qualified individuals and putting the pieces together for the sake of getting this out.
Well, because people have to realize if those two events didn't happen, we wouldn't be living in the America that we're living in today.
Oh, you're so right, Maria. We had a whole succession of presidents who would never have occupied that office, but for the death of JFK. Those include, of course, Lyndon Johnson, Richard Nixon, Gerald Ford, George Herbert Walker Bush, and then his son W., who never would have been taken seriously for that role had his father not served. The case of Ford is very interesting because, well, that we have the shirt and the jacket he was wearing that show that wound to the back 5.5 inches below the collar to the right of the spinal column. We have the autopsy diagram. We have an FBI sketch. We have the president's personal physician's death certificate. We even have reenactment photographs by the Warren Commission staff, Maria, that show a stand-in for JFK with a large patch at that location, and then a much smaller one at the back of the head where he actually was hit in the back of the head by that other shot fired by Skadro. But the fact is that, you know, Gerald Ford had the description of the wound changed from his uppermost back, which was already an exaggeration, to the base of the back of the neck to make the magic bullet theory more plausible, because the initial conclusion of the FBI and the Secret Service had been there had been three shots with three hits, that Jack had been hit in the back where he actually was hit in the back, that Connolly had been hit in the back, and then Jack had been hit in the back of the head. But after they discovered that James Tague had been injured by a shot that missed, they had to either acknowledge a fourth shot or reduce the role to account for one shot that missed and therefore account for all the wounds using only two, which led to the, you know, imaginative introduction of the magic bullet theory. And that was even being perpetuated during this 50th observance. I couldn't believe it.
Oh, yeah, they had to reinforce the official lies over and over again.
Over and over again, and there was a father and son team who appeared on ABC, which said that they'd modeled the neck using a chunk of soap that was a very close approximation to the musculature of the neck, except that it didn't contain any vertebrae. So that, you know, as long as Jack Kennedy had a backbone, this is one of the reasons why he was assassinated, because figuratively he had a backbone in addition to literally having a backbone. Because David W. Manick, MD, PhD, who's the leading expert on the medical evidence, took a CAT scan of a patient with similar chest and neck dimensions and sought to plot the trajectory of the magic bullet from its alleged entry to its alleged exit, where he actually had that wound of entry in the front of his throat, and found that it's not even anatomically possible because cervical vertebrae intervene. So the whole thing is a charade.
Oh, yeah.
Not only had Lyndon playing the key role in setting things up, where Billy Saul Estes, who knew these people, the players, up close and personal, including Malcolm Mack Wallace, told a French investigative reporter, William Raymond, how Lyndon had sent his chief administrative assistant, Cliff Carter, down to Dallas to make sure all the arrangements were in place for the assassination, and where he had conversation with Cliff Carter and Mack Wallace both before and after the assassination and became convinced they'd played a key role in it. And, of course, a Mack Wallace fingerprint was found on one of the boxes set up for the assassin's lair, so that he was involved in, you know, making sure that it looked sort of right, like a shooter could have shot there. But those who have actually taken a good look realize it's not even a possible shooting scenario, because there are pipes in the corner. There's not enough room for a shooter to get the appropriate stance. You know, the motorcade was disappearing behind a tree.
Right.
If there had been a lone shooter there, Maria, as you well know, they would have taken their shots as the motorcade was coming up Houston, heading directly for the depository when the body and the head are getting closer and closer. Even a mediocre marksman like Oswald, that he had a decent weapon, might have been able to take out Jack under those conditions, but instead they wanted to get him into the kill zone where they had a multiplicity of shooters and arranged for a triangular assassination, as I explained in that article.
Mm. Well, Jim, I got to tell you, this your latest articles really rock, and they're great. So I want to really thank you again for joining me this month. I can barely wait to talk to you again next month.
My great pleasure, Maria. You do a great job, and I'm really pleased to be here with you.
Great. Take care, Jim.
You too.
Jim Fetzer, check out his work at veteranstoday.com. Tomorrow, Dave McGowan, Send in the Clowns episode for the month. Always worth plenty of laughs. So thanks for listening and supporting the show, and I'll see you guys tomorrow.
Thank you for listening and supporting the Maria Show. Tell others what you learned today. Knowledge becomes wisdom only when it's shared. Encourage others to subscribe today. www.maria.net. Often imitated, never duplicated. A world of information all in one place. www.maria.net. Always ahead of the curve. Always on your side. Get active or get radioactive. Subscribe today.